the case for democracy, no less than the case against slavery, rests on the legitimacy of the people's consent. To outlaw slavery without the consent of the majority of whites would be to destroy democracy. Indeed, to destroy the very basis for outlawing slavery itself. The men gathered in Philadelphia were in a peculiar predicament. For them to sanction slavery would be to proclaim the illegitimacy of the American Revolution and the new form of government based on the people's consent. Yet for them to outlaw slavery without securing the people's consent would have the same effect. In practical terms as well, the choice facing the founders was not to permit or to prohibit slavery. Rather, the choice was either to establish a union in which slavery was tolerated, or not to have a union at all. Any suggestion that the southern states could have been persuaded to join a union and give up slavery can be dismissed as preposterous. As Harry Jaffa puts it, had the founders insisted upon securing all the rights of all men, they would have ended up securing no rights for anybody. Thus, the accusation that the founders compromised on the Declaration's principle that all men are created equal for the purpose of expediency reflects a grave misunderstanding. The founders were confronted with a competing principle that is also present in the Declaration. Governments derive their legitimacy from the consent of the governed. Both principles must be satisfied, and when they cannot be, compromise is not merely permissible, but morally required. The framers found a middle ground, not between principle and practice, but between opposition to slavery and majority consent. They produced a constitution in which the concept of slavery is tolerated in deference to consent, but not given any moral approval in recognition of the slaves' natural rights. Nowhere in the document is the term slavery used. Slaves are always described as persons, implying their possession of natural rights. The founders were also careful to approve a constitution that refuses to acknowledge the existence of racial distinctions, thus producing a document that transcended its time. None of the supposed contradictions that contemporary scholars have located in the founding documents were unrecognized by the founders. Many of the framers justified their toleration of slavery on prudential grounds, for in the 1770s and 1780s, they had reason to believe that slavery was losing its commercial appeal. In this, they were wrong, because Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin in 1793, which the founders could not have anticipated, revived the demand for slavery in the South. Even so, the test of the founders' project is the practical consequence. Did the founding strengthen or weaken the institution of slavery? The American Revolution should be judged by its consequences. Before 1776, slavery was legal in every state in America. Yet by 1804, every state north of Maryland had abolished slavery, either immediately or gradually. Southern and border states prohibited further importations of slaves from abroad, and Congress was committed to outlawing the slave trade in 1808, which it did. Slavery was no longer a national but a sectional institution, and one under moral and political siege. Abraham Lincoln not only perceived the founders' dilemma, he inherited it. The principle of popular rule is based on Jefferson's doctrine that all men are created equal, yet the greatest crisis in American history arose when the people denied that all men are created equal, and in doing so denied the basis of their own legitimacy. Lincoln had two choices: work to overthrow democracy, or work to secure consent through persuasion. Conscious that he too must defer, as the founders did, to prevailing prejudices, Lincoln nevertheless sought to neutralize those prejudices, so they did not become a barrier to securing black freedom. In a series of artfully conditional claims, "If God gave the black man little, that little let him enjoy," Lincoln paid ritual obeisance to existing racism while drawing even racists into his coalition to end slavery. He made these rhetorical concessions because he knew that the possibility for securing anti-slavery consent was far better in his time than in the 1780s. Commenting on the Declaration of Independence, Lincoln said of the founders, "They intended to include all men, but they did not intend to declare all men equal in all respects. They defined with tolerable distinctness in what respects they did consider all men created equal, equal in certain inalienable rights. They did not mean to assert the obvious untruth that all were then actually enjoying that equality, nor yet that they were about to confer it immediately upon them. They meant simply to declare the right, so that the enforcement of it must follow as fast as circumstances should permit." By working through, rather than around, the democratic process, Lincoln justified the nation's faith in the untried experiment of representative self-government. In vindicating the slave's right to rule himself, Lincoln also vindicated the legitimacy of democratic self-rule. Thus, it is accurate to say that Lincoln gave America a new birth of freedom. Lincoln's position came to be shared by Frederick Douglass, who had once denounced the Constitution, but who eventually reached the conclusion that it contained anti-slavery principles. "Abolish slavery tomorrow, and not a sentence or syllable of the Constitution needs to be altered," Douglass said. Slavery, he concluded, was merely scaffolding to the magnificent structure to be removed as soon as the building was completed. Douglass came to understand what contemporary multiculturalists apparently do not, that the best anti-slavery program is not necessarily support for the grandest, impractical scheme, but rather is that which deals the deadliest blow to slavery that can be given at a particular time. It took a civil war to destroy slavery, and more than 500,000 whites were killed in that war, one life for every 6 slaves freed, C. Van Woodward reminds us. But for Lincoln, as for Douglass, the greatest white and black statesmen of the time, the triumph of the Union and the emancipation of the slaves represented not the victory of might over right, but the reverse. Justice had won out over expediency, and the principles of the American founding had at long last been realized. The founders exercised wisdom and prudence in producing a charter for a society immeasurably better than the one in which they found themselves. History has vindicated their philosophical statesmanship. Black Americans, and indeed all of us, owe the American founders a profound debt of gratitude. Having examined the issue of slavery, let us now discuss racism. Racism is a doctrine of innate or biological superiority. In its classic form, it leads to discrimination, which deprives members of victimized groups the equal protection of the laws. While slavery ended in the United States nearly a century and a half ago, racism continues to exist. Many African American leaders insist that it is as bad as, if not worse than, it ever was. "Racism is as healthy today as it was during the Enlightenment," says Nobel laureate Toni Morrison. "Racism is an integral, permanent, and indestructible component of this society," writes legal scholar Derek Bell. These writers hold societal racism responsible for the current problems of blacks. Is America to blame because African Americans are not doing as well as members of other groups? As an immigrant, I am constantly surprised by how much I hear racism talked about and how little I actually see it. Even fewer are the incidents in which I have experienced it directly. When one examines the policies of universities, companies, and the government, one finds that they actually discriminate in favor of African Americans and other minority groups and against white males. Socially, most Americans go out of their way to cater to and avoid offending blacks. Such measures seem unlikely in a racist society. There are specific incidents of racism and specific victims, but the very fact that we can identify them proves that they are not typical, and the ensuing outcry shows the degree to which racism has become stigmatized in American society. For the past several years, I have been speaking at American colleges on the issue of affirmative action. Inevitably, some student or professor will harangue me about how indispensable racial preferences are at that particular school because of the pervasiveness of racism and discrimination.